Luke chapter 7, Jesus and the disciples are in Capernaum, which is just a few miles north of the Sea of Galilee. This is the home of several of the disciples, where Jesus based his ministry out of for a large portion of his ministry. There is this Roman centurion in Capernaum. He has a slave who he really likes. Now this centurion is a Roman officer. He's also highly regarded in this community, so the text tells us in Luke 7. Now the community is Jewish. So we have this immediate red flag straight away as we're reading. The Romans are the occupying army. Capernaum is a Jewish community under occupation. The centurion is almost certainly an unclean Gentile from the Jewish perspective. So for this guy to be highly regarded, he has to be pretty incredible, right? Well, the Roman centurion sends some Jewish elders to Jesus. These guys practically beg Jesus to come heal this centurion's slave. Quote, "He is worthy for you to grant this to him, for he loves our nation, and it was he who built us our synagogue." End quote. A Jewish group of elders begging Jesus to come help a centurion who, by the way, built them their very own synagogue. This is incredible. And the centurion then has this fantastic display of faith. He understands authority, right? And Jesus marvels at this display. The same word that's used, by the way, when Mary and Joseph hear all these prophecies being spoken over Jesus way back in Luke chapter 2. It says, quote, "His father and mother were amazed at the things which were being said about him," end quote. And the people throughout Luke are marveling about Jesus, the miracles that he is producing. Luke chapter 9, verse 43, the people marveled at everything Jesus is doing, all these miracles. But this is the one time in Luke, now here in chapter 7, it's the one time in Luke, the only time, when Jesus himself is amazed. What does it take to catch Jesus by surprise? What do we have to do to throw God in living human form a curveball? Well, be a Gentile, non-Jewish, Roman representative of imperial power, but then be so invested in the local Jewish community that you build them a synagogue. And then, on top of this, you so confidently grasp. See, this guy didn't just understand that Jesus was somehow God, by the way. He also grasps something fundamental about how the spiritual world works that apparently no one else was able to see, including the Jewish elders. This God isn't limited by time and space. This God doesn't even need to be physically present to heal. But he gets the idea of authority in a way, this centurion. He gets this idea of authority in a way that none of the Jewish believers throughout Galilee understand. See, I've commanded armies, troops, and slaves. They do what I say, because that's the way the system works. And I'm fully conscious of the authority I bring to my job. And Jesus, I see that you have an authority that works the same way. As Western readers, you and I certainly don't grow up thinking of Jesus in anything like a military sense, like a military commander. We're associating military imagery to Jesus or what he was about. Think about Revelation, though. Chapter 19, verse 11, quote, "And I saw heaven opened, and behold," you can substitute, "oh crap, and oh crap, a white horse, and he who sat on it is called faithful and true, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. His eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems," end quote. A diadem, if you don't know, was a blue and white decoration. Persian kings used to tie these onto their head. It's a crown, not just for the king, but for the military commander of the army. He has a name written on him which no one knows except himself. In much ancient Near Eastern thought, to know the name of a god was to grab for yourself a portion of that god's power. There are entire mythological tales from the ancient Near East, where a mortal man, usually a man, would attempt to trick a deity into revealing its name to gain power over that deity. And we'll see this in the next podcast, actually, when Jesus asks the group of demons possessing a certain man in Galilee what their name is. But no one has that advantage here in Revelation. No one knows his name. He's coming as a military conqueror whose power is not shared. Then you do get the name in Revelation 19, verse 13. Quote, "He is clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses." End quote. And it goes on from there. This military language might make us somewhat uncomfortable, makes us squirm a little bit, that cuddly Jesus is going to come back onto the scene with a robe dripping in blood. You see why "behold" doesn't quite cut it. Oh crap, is right. If these images make you uncomfortable, though, think through the imagery a bit more. Read back through Revelation. What is it that Jesus is returning to wage war against? Well, it's not you. It's not me. This is a spiritual war. Luke is helping us decipher this, actually. The centurion gets it, remember? Jesus, as a military commander, all he has to do is say the word, and the sickness, a spiritual remnant of the old military order, the defeated prince, is under orders to leave. Okay. Let's keep setting the scene for Luke 8. Jesus, after this encounter with the centurion, then heals a young boy. This is similar to what Elijah and Elisha do in the books of Kings. The people in Luke 7, verse 16, keep saying things like, "A great prophet has risen among us." Not that they recognize Jesus fully, but they recognize what a prophet does, which is raise people from the dead, going off of their experience in the text with Elijah and Elisha. And then there's this fantastic scene where John the Baptist sends two of his disciples to Jesus, and he asks, "Are you the expected one, or do we look for someone else?" We're meant to notice this contrast between the centurion just a few verses ago, who sends people to Jesus saying, "I know what you're here to do, and I'm on board." But now here's John the Baptist saying, "Are you really the guy? Or should I maybe start looking for another savior?" Remember, John's rotting in prison at this point, and he's about to find his head on a plate served up before Herod's daughter. Confidence and doubt. Yet, notice that Jesus praises both men. He compliments the Roman on his faith. But about John, he says, quote, "This man is more than a prophet," end quote. Who was just being called a prophet? Jesus. Jesus honors the man who just doubted him by calling him more than a prophet. Honest, searching doubt always has a place at God's table. Honest confidence in God's presence through our sufferings and his authority to work through suffering also always has a place at God's table. These things are not mutually exclusive. Doubt and confidence dance together in Luke 7, which has some profound implications for our own faith journey. Perhaps, I would suggest yes. Okay. Then there's a woman who washes Jesus' feet with her hair. Then there's a parable of two debtors, which Jesus uses to explain to his host why he is forgiving this woman's sins, the one washing Jesus' feet, their hair. Not only are doubt and confidence dancing together in Luke 7, but also healing and forgiveness, honor and scandal. So all this has been in Capernaum. Luke 8, Jesus starts moving around. The disciples, of course, travel with him. Luke 8, verse 1, quote, he began going around from one city and village to another, end quote. We're meant to notice in verses 2 and 3 that there are multiple female disciples at this point. Not only are they traveling with Jesus, but they're also financially supporting all of these travels through their own money. Now, he tells a couple parables, one about the sower planting different seeds on the ground, the other of the lamp, which we don't have time to get into. And then we get into 8, verse 22. Somewhere in the midst of this town hopping that they're doing, imagine trying to keep up with Jesus on a mission trip, like on foot. Was Jesus a fast walker? Did he stop and hug every child that they came across? Fred Rogers' wife, Mr. Rogers' wife, has spoken about how it was impossible to get him through a crowd of people, because he just constantly stopped and have conversations. What was Jesus like as a tour guide? Don't you kind of wonder what the day-to-day journey with Jesus was like? Not the spiritual journey, although that's what we, of course, focus on. But I'm referring to the actual day-to-day experience of keeping pace with Jesus in the flesh. I mean, did he crack jokes on the trail? Do you think he was at the front? Or was he a back of the packer? Speculation's fun. Anyhow, verse 22. Jesus and the disciples are going to hop across the Sea of Galilee. So they pile into this boat and start across the lake, which we don't know really where they're starting off from, but since they end up on the eastern shore in verse 26, they probably started out from either the city of Tiberias, which is on the western shore, or maybe from the north shore near Capernaum, since that's where they just were. But they're sailing west to east, generally, in a straight shot. This would take hour to hour and a half on a calm day. Now, if you were on this boat with the rest of the disciples, probably the first thing you notice is that this boat is awfully crowded. If you go up to the Galilee region today, you can visit the kibbutz at a little town named Gennesar. It's just north of Tiberias on the western shore, the Sea of Galilee. Now, preserved there is a 1st century BCE or 1st century CE fishing boat. It was excavated from the lake shore back in 1986. Now, it's called the Jesus Boat for fairly obvious reasons relating to the tourist trade. Call something the Jesus Boat and watch the pilgrims flock to it. And the tour buses roll in. Forgive my snark there. There's not any reason to believe, of course, that this boat was the boat used by Jesus or the disciples at any point. In fact, it's thought that this kind of boat was incredibly common on the sea during the 1st and 2nd centuries CE. But it's a very valuable find, because it's fairly easy to say that this boat is representative of the kind of boat that Jesus and the 12 would have piled into. And when you examine this boat, it's only 27 feet long, 7.5 feet wide, 4 feet tall. If you're doing the math, each grown man gets about 2 feet to himself in this thing. The next thing you notice is the geography around you. The Sea of Galilee is surrounded by low hills, sits in a sort of bowl. The Jordan flows in from the top of the lake from the north, and then exits from the south and continues on towards the Dead Sea. Now, we've mentioned the hills. If you keep heading east from the sea, up the hill country, take a look out towards the northeast. What you'd see dominating the landscape is this tall mountain called Mount Hermon. It's across the border, the modern border, in Syria. Mount Hermon is something to see. It towers above the rest of the landscape. There's snow on it a good portion of the year. It generally just looks foreboding and remote, like a powerful and ancient god could have lived up there. And we'll get more to that idea in just a minute. It turns out the people living in Galilee sort of thought the same thing. But we're on the boat, and Jesus at some point drifts off to sleep. And how many of you think that this was kind of intentional? They would have all seen this storm coming. They would have felt the wind picking up. Pretty obviously, they're going to be caught in the middle of the lake during the storm. And then verse 23 hits. Quote, "A fierce gale of wind descended on the lake, and it began to be swamped and to be in danger." End quote. Now, we need to start noticing the specific language that's being used. The Greek here for the descent of the wind from the hills. It's also sometimes used for deities, for gods, for heavenly messengers descending from on high to earth, to the land of mortals. Though we have to be careful with these kinds of semantic games, sometimes a word is just a word. And no matter how many times people yell and scream about the travesties of translation, how we can never capture the essence of meaning from one language to the next, but we do have to be somewhat cautious that we don't attach too much meaning to a particular word when it may not necessarily be warranted. Anyhow, just keep this in the back of your mind, that the descending wind might be perceived as a deity descending to earth. This wind picks up. The text captures their situation. They're in danger. The waves are rising up above the boat. So the disciples then have to wake Jesus up. And again, tell me this wasn't planned, at least a little. It can be helpful to think of Jesus not just as the Holy Son of God, but when we try to understand something that Jesus says or does in one of the Gospels, we also need to at least try to wrap our minds around Jesus acting within the bounds of his humanity. Jesus is a teacher, a master teacher, in the tradition of the Pharisees. This is a teaching tradition that goes back hundreds of years by this point. And I can't help but see some purposeful pedagogy here. Jesus, as a master teacher, knows that motion creates emotion. A life lesson learned in a stressful situation tends to stick much more than one learned in the comfort of a classroom between coffee and an early lunch. Jesus is asleep. The disciples accuse Jesus of being callous. "Master, Master, we're perishing." The same account presented in Mark chapter 4, verse 38, states it even more emphatically. "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" You can sense perhaps some dark humor here. Jesus sort of groggily opens his eyes as the waves are crashing over his face and soaking his clothes. By the way, all 13 of these guys are by this time completely soaked. Jesus stands up in the boat. Picture grown men crashing into him as he does this. The boat is all over the place. And Jesus rebukes the wind and the surging waves. Quote, "He got up and rebuked the wind and the surging waves, and they stopped, and it became calm." End quote. Another instance where every word matters. There isn't a word out of place in this verse, verse 24. He rebukes two things, the wind and the waves. They stop and becomes calm. 30 seconds ago, we were in the midst of this raging storm. Now it's quiet. The lake is like glass. He turns to them, soaking wet, plastered sideways on the deck, and they're afraid. What do they say to one another, trying to be out of earshot of Jesus as, I don't know, Maybe he wrings out his cloak and starts drying his hair, you know, his long, blonde Scandinavian hair. Just imagining here. And obviously the Scandinavian thing is a dig. But these disciples are now whispering to one another, who is this? Who is this that commands even the winds and the water, and they listen to him? Do you ever wonder why the disciples are afraid here? They should be at least appreciative, right? I mean, don't they know they're sailing with Jesus? Boy, there's a morning devotional for you. Sailing with Jesus. Don't they by now just sort of expect that Jesus is going to pull a rabbit out of his God hat, make everything all right, if they really get into trouble? I mean, that's kind of the assumption we make modern day, right? It's fairly obvious to me, I think, when you read the entirety of the gospel accounts, the disciples right up to the end actually seem to have very little idea of who Jesus is. It's not until he's dead and buried and starts showing up all over town. It's not until then that it finally lands for these guys just who it was they were with. Yeah, I mean, I for one don't think this is because these guys were uneducated or stupid or thick. I have to reject that. I think Jesus was pretty purposeful in how he led these guys into encounters like this one to show them aspects of his divinity that they were never going to forget. We can really start to appreciate the disciples' reaction if we take a few minutes to dig into what might be behind their fear. To do this, we need to understand the place of elemental deities in the ancient Near Eastern mind. Now, an elemental deity is just a fancy phrase for a god that would have been understood as part of nature. So many cultures would have had a god of the sea, god of the wind. The sun and the moon might be gods. Even dew on the grass could be a separate god. If you've got some familiarity with the Old Testament, you might know that the old Canaanite gods were understood at times as elemental deities. And you might also then be familiar with Baal. His name is actually Baal, but that gets really annoying to pronounce after a while, and probably annoying to listen to. So we're just going to stick with Baal. Now, Baal was a Canaanite god, meaning some version of Baal is being worshipped in the second millennium BCE and into the first millennium BCE in places like modern-day Israel, southern Turkey, Lebanon, Syria. Baal was the storm god. He's the source of lightning, wind, and rain. For these reasons, he is also sometimes connected with fertility and agriculture. He's thought to live at the top of the highest mountain in the area. Now, this mountain would be different based on where geographically we're situated. Here in Galilee, Mount Hermon, which I mentioned earlier, would be the largest mountain and thought to be Baal's home. The Old Testament has all kinds of fun with Baal. He seems to be the central Canaanite deity which was causing problems between the people of Israel and their god Yahweh. The Israelites keep wandering away from Yahweh and towards Baal, which has caused some people to speculate that the Israelites were actually originally Canaanites, and that the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt was a far messier and more modest affair, numbers-wise, than the Bible portrays it as. There are some really interesting theories about how the exiles from Egypt intermingle with the local communities in the hills of Canaan, and that Israel and Judah are actually, you know, products of that loose alliance, which might be one reason why these Canaanite gods keep showing up. Now, the purpose of today's podcast isn't really to go into those theories, and they all have merits and they all have drawbacks. The biblical account of the Exodus needs to be reckoned with in its own right. Some of the theories that posit that it happened differently than that, they have their merits, but they also, more often than not always, tend to be overly dismissive of the biblical account, which I don't particularly like that. Anyhow, just know that there's some different theories about how all that happened, and some of the merit of thinking through how the Exodus really took place and how the people really settled in the land of Canaan, who would eventually become the Israelites, is that the system of Canaanite religion seems to be constantly a temptation for them. They must have some deep investment in Canaanite mythology at some point during the development of Israel as a nation. Let's look at 1 Kings 18. This is where the prophet Elijah has King Ahab, who worships Baal, call together all of the prophets of Baal at Mount Carmel for a prophetic showdown, sort of grand slam. 450 prophets of Baal against one lone prophet of Yahweh, which is Elijah. Verse 21, quote, "Elijah came near to all the people and said, 'How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If Yahweh is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him.' But the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, 'I alone am left a prophet of Yahweh, but Baal's prophets are 450 men.'" End quote. The lone Jedi against the disciples of the Dark Lord of the Sith. Or try 2 Kings chapter 10 on for size, starting in verse 18. Yehu is in the midst of this wild killing spree, bloodthirst in the name of Yahweh. And at the risk of being off topic, I just want us to bask in this hedonistic culling of the Baal worshippers by Yehu. Quote, "Then Yehu gathered all the people and said to them, 'Ahab served Baal a little. Yehu will serve him much. Now, summon all of the prophets of Baal, all his worshippers, and all his priests. Let no one be missing, for I have a great sacrifice for Baal. Whoever is missing shall not live.'" End quote. But Yehu did this in cunning, so that he might destroy the worshippers of Baal. And Yehu said, "Sanctify a solemn assembly for Baal." And they proclaimed it. Then Yehu sent throughout Israel, and all the worshippers of Baal came, so that there was not a man left who did not come. And when they went into the house of Baal was filled from one end to the other. He said to the one who was in charge of the wardrobe, "Bring out garments for all the worshippers of Baal." So he brought out garments for them. Yehu went into the house of Baal with Jehonadab, son of Rechab, and he said to the worshippers of Baal, "Search and see that there is here with you none of the servants of Yahweh, but only the worshippers of Baal." Then they went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings. Now, Yehu had stationed for himself 80 men outside. And he said, "The one who permits any of the men whom I bring into your hands to escape shall give up his life in exchange." End quote. You get a sense of how extreme the theology of Israel was caught between these competing forces. Canaanite gods like Baal on the one side, Yahweh on the other. Luckily, we can also get the smallest sense of the Canaanite perspective of Baal from some of the preserved tablets at Ugarit, which is on the west coast of modern Syria. In this tablet that I'm about to read from, Baal, remember he's the storm god on the top of the mountain, enters into conflict with another deity named Yam. Yam is the god of the sea, the waves. In a broader sense, the sea in ancient Near Eastern thought is often representative of the primordial chaos, disorder. We see this idea back in Genesis chapter 1, where the Spirit of God hovers over the deep, the disorder. That's the idea of Yam. Here we have a second millennium BCE tablet from Ugarit. It begins with Baal making his battle plans against Yam. Quote, "There with the sword I will lay waste. I will burn down his house. The powerful one will fall to the earth, the mighty one to the dust. Hardly has the word left his mouth, the utterance of his lips, when she pronounces, under the throne with Prince Yam. Kotaro wa Hisisu speaks up. I hereby announce to you, Prince Bale, and I repeat to you, Cloud Rider, as for your enemy, O Bale, as for your enemy, you will smite him, you will destroy your adversary. End quote. So here Bale is the hero. He's the one we're meant to be cheering for. This mythological battle between Bale and Yam, the storm and the sea, was widely known throughout the ancient Near East, and really is indicative of the larger trend in many ancient cultures to mythologize natural phenomena. By the time of the disciples, 1st century CE, Bale and Yam have kind of faded to the background. And this is due in part to the many foreign powers that have come through in the 8th to 5th centuries BCE and then later, who have displaced and influenced the local religious beliefs. So Baal and Yam by Jesus' day might have been usurped to some extent by the Greek or Roman deities, the rough equivalents to Baal and Yam, from their pantheon of gods overseeing natural phenomena. But we really can't discount the power that local folk religion still had over these guys living in a remote backwater of the Roman Empire in the first century. You know, we tend to think of the disciples as fully, at least fully Jewish, monotheistic. But in general, I can't help but wonder if it's more correct to view them as loosely Jewish. But also influenced to an extent by the folk religions that would have continued around the Galilee area during this time. And I think the disciples' reaction to this scene in Luke bears that out. To be caught on the lake in the midst of a storm was to be caught between two gods fighting for supremacy. Like I mentioned previously, the language of the passage is very specific. The wind descends down from the hills. Bale descends down. The winds, the waves are now reaching up above the boat. Yam, chaos, death, rises from the depths to contend with mighty Bale, who descends down. And what does Jesus do? He got up and rebuked the wind and the surging waves, and they stopped, and it became calm. And they were fearful and amazed, saying to one another, "Who then is this, that he commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him?" Who are we following that can sleep calmly while the eternal struggle of Bale and Yam plays out right in front of us with our lives in the balance? Who is this? Who is this guy that can command Bale and Yam and they obey him? It's nice to be back in narrative, to have a storyline to sort of bring us through the text. I'm not a pure theology guy. When things get too theoretical, I get a little antsy. I usually need some kind of an anchor point to be sure that what we're studying has a direct relevance to modern belief lived out. That's why I would never survive just being a theologian for theology's sake. I can think of a few things worse. Some of the methodologies that are in play in modern biblical studies that impose these very obtuse studies of semantic register, participant analysis, subtle shifts in voice of the text, I'm very appreciative of these kinds of more theoretical methods, and I happily will look at their abstracts and the results of all that hard work. But subjecting a biblical text to one of those methods myself, just the thought, is fairly torturous. The kind of analysis that I'm leading us through with Luke is very similar to the kind of analysis we did with Judges. If you downloaded and listened to that series on Judges a couple years back, it's a fairly straightforward historical approach, considering the culture, language, politics, geography, and of course the broader religious context of the time period, and then applying those insights to the biblical text. It's the kind of analysis that I find generally most satisfying. Linguistic studies, redaction, critical approaches, these things have their place, as do many other methods that are currently being employed, but I'm perfectly happy for us to live mainly in this historical critical approach. I'll happily keep plugging through the narrative of Luke for the next few episodes, and then we might drift back to the Old Testament and talk through some issues in Genesis. You heard some creation-oriented themes and direct echoes of the Genesis account today. And a couple listeners and readers of the blog have brought up some of the classic questions that arise from the text of Genesis, so I think it's a natural place for us to head next. But next time, we will cover more of Luke, starting right off with an exorcism. So, you have that to look forward to. Grace and peace.